My name is Art Hansen, and I'm an emeritus professor from Cal State Fullerton, and have been involved in the Japanese American story since 1972. So I have been to a lot of these conferences, and I'm familiar with most of the people that are here. And it's so wonderful to be here because I see people from different parts of the past. And at first, there's kind of a veil that covers both of us, and then we break through the veil, and we have recognition. And then when the recognition gets greater, then we hug and stuff like this. And so this has been a wonderful experience to be here. And we have a great session for you, and you're at the right session if you're at the session that's titled Border Crossings, a Comparative Assessment of Japanese-American and Japanese-Canadian Redress. Okay? Yesterday at the general proceedings for this conference, Mitch Maki and Tom Ikeda both made very articulate, very penetrating, very memorable presentations. Mitch Maki, during the course of his talk, introduced people who he referred to as our true heroes. These were people in uniform. These were people who served in World War II. These were people who risked their lives and oftentimes gave up their limbs. When Tom Ikeda came up, he focused most of his attention on his most memorable interviewee, who was Gordon Hirabayashi. Gordon Hirabayashi, of course, was a resister, a constitutional resister. He was also a conscientious objector. The point of this juxtaposition between these two people is the fact that we know that heroes come in different forms and different and have different styles and wear even different outfits. Today we're going to deal with people who are heroes of a different stripe. My heroes have always been people who have been involved in resistance activities in the camps, after the camps. Those people who I would say chose the path of the greatest resistance in life rather than the least resistance to gain democracy, justice, and dignity. And those in the redress movement oftentimes became heroes for me, and I'm sure for you as well. And some of the talks that we've had enshrines this idea that the people that decided, for instance, that something needed to be done to right this past wrong or attempt to remedy it in some way was worth the fight. Our panel today consists of three of these heroic figures. And I'm going to introduce them before each of their separate presentations, but I just want to embrace them as a group right now as heroic figures. They may not think of themselves as heroes, but some of us think of them that way, and I think that history will think of them that particular way too. Our panel has a comparative kind of focus where we're comparing, et cetera, two different experiences. And I have not really pushed this comparison thing with the panelists, so don't expect the panelists to perform as comparative analysts or comparative historians or comparative public policy experts. But I want to say something about comparative analysis. To have a worthwhile comparison, what you have to do is to avoid the extreme of thinking of the two groups that you're involved in comparison as being so much the same that you conflate them into one and you miss the differences between the two. And then the other problem is the opposite. When you take the comparison, you focus so much on the differences that you don't see the similarities. And so what you want to try to do in comparative analysis is to reach a dynamic equilibrium between the samenesses and the differences. So what I want you to do today in listening to these is to think about how are the two redress movements across the 49th parallel the same, and how are they different? The first person that we're going to have speak to us is Mitch Mockey. And he's easily recognizable over there. He's the youngest, and he's also the tallest, and he's the most male.
Thank you.
He right now occupies a position as vice provost, which doesn't mean a provost in charge of vice, although he could probably fill that position too. But he's the vice provost of academic affairs at Cal State University in Dominguez Hills. He is a Sanse. He was born in 1961, which was a year after I graduated from college. So he thinks we're making fun of him by giving his age out and everything. I think this is very charitable. He was born and raised in Los Angeles, and when he was a college student, he became active in the redress movement. He participated in candlelight ceremonies, letter-writing campaigns, and lobbying for the California State redress bill. His parents were from Hawaii, and no one in Mitch's family was directly affected by the exclusion and incarceration experience during World War II. He was so taken with the issue of redress that he was the lead coordinator of a conference that was held at UCLA on Japanese-American redress. And he also became the lead author of a book that grew out of that conference called Achieving the Impossible Dream. It's a great piece of work. Roger Daniels, who was the editor of the Illinois Asian American series, told me that this was by far and away the biggest seller in that very large series. So this was an impressive achievement. And he has also directed for JANM, for the Japanese American National Museum, a redress oral history project. And he did interviews all around the United States with redress leaders. So if you go to the website for JANM, which is Discover Nikkei, you can find selected interviews from that project. Okay, so with that, I will welcome Mitch to just stay there and give your
talk.
You can come up here if you want.
I'd rather stand and talk.
Okay.
You all know me as someone who stands and talks, right? So.
I'll put your book right here so you can see it.
Thank you, Art, for that kind introduction and for telling everyone my age, and I won't take that as a compliment then. But, you know, one of the things Art said is very true. Heroes come in all shapes and sizes and wear different uniforms. And, Art, I want to say that you are one of my heroes. As a professor in the Cal State system, you have been a role model. You have always conducted yourself with great integrity and authenticity and sincerity, and I really appreciate all that you've done for our community and for the museum. You are one of my heroes. Okay, and with that, I now have 14 and a half minutes. And what my job here to do is to briefly talk about the Japanese-American redress movement post-war up until the commission hearings, and I'll conclude with that. And we can use that as a backdrop to compare ourselves with the Canadian experience. So 1945, the war ends, and between 1945 and 1947, the camps start to close. Japanese Americans are given $25 and a one-way train ticket to go and reestablish their lives. And as they go and start to reestablish their lives, many of them are leaving camp not with the idea of let's start a social movement, let's demand an apology, we need to right this terrible wrong. They left camp with what you might expect would be their priorities. Let's put a roof over our head. Let's put food on our table. Let's send our children back to school. Let's put together our neighborhoods once again. Let's reestablish our lives. But along with those priorities also was a sense of shame. A sense of shame that somehow we had not been American enough. We had done something wrong that caused this great travesty of justice to be imposed upon us. And the best analogy that I can give you would be of a sexual assault victim who, through no fault of her own, was sexually assaulted and feels that somehow she contributed to that travesty of justice. We as a community felt that collective shame, and that's why many of our Nisei parents would say to us, let's be 110% American. Let's be so American that this will never happen to us again. And many Sansei my age and a little bit older, we don't speak Japanese, and much of that culture was lost because of this process of blaming ourselves and blaming the victim for what had happened. After the war in 1948, we have the Japanese-American Evacuation Claims Act, which provides the first sense of redress for what happened during World War II. However, this act didn't address the constitutional violations that occurred. It only addressed property losses. And you had to have receipts. You had to have receipts for those things that you lost. And I don't know about you, but when we're told we only have a few days to pack up what we can carry, receipts are not the number one thing that I packed. Much of that was lost, and as a result, only about 10 cents on every dollar that was lost by most Japanese Americans was returned by the Japanese American Evacuation Claims Act. In the 1950s, our nation begins to change. In 1952, we have the McCarran-Walters Act, which allows for the very first time Issei to naturalize. Up until this point, as many of you know, Issei, who had been here 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, had not been allowed to become American citizens. In 1954, we have Brown versus Board of Education, which says that separate but equal is no longer the law of the land. So our nation is beginning to change, and the civil rights movement starts to take hold. But something happens in 1959, which in hindsight opens the door that someday we might get recognized. Someday we may get an apology. Any guess what happens in 1959 that creates that opportunity? Go ahead. Hawaii becomes a state. Hawaii becomes a state. And why is that important? Because with statehood comes representation. We get two senators, we get one representative, and at that time, and still today, Hawaii had a large Asian American population, and in particular, a large Japanese American population. And in fact, the first representative that was elected from the 50th state of Hawaii was none other than a young man named Daniel K. Inoue. And as many of you know, Daniel Inoue had served in the 442nd and had lost his right arm in battle fighting for his country, the United States of America. So what better symbol of loyalty to send to Congress than somebody who had fought for his country, given his right arm, and was an American son? Daniel K. Inoue became the first representative, and eventually in 1962 was elected to the U.S. Senate. But in the 1960s, we as a community, the average Japanese American family, was a long ways away from thinking about redress, a long ways away from thinking about fighting for an apology. And as an example, in 1963 at UCLA, Roger Daniels, who Art mentioned, Roger Daniels was teaching a class. His first assignment was to have the students write an autobiography. He had two young Sansei males in his class, and they both turned in their autobiographies. And in both autobiographies, it started off, I was born in Los Angeles in 1943. Blah, 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 blah. Dr. Daniels read this, and he said, there's a problem here. He called his two students into his office, and he said, there's a problem with your autobiographies. And they looked at him and said, we didn't cheat, Dr. Daniels. I mean, how do you cheat on an autobiography, right? So he says, that's not what I'm talking about. Go home, talk to your families, come back and see me. And sure enough, the next day, one of the young men came back and said, you're right, Dr. Daniels. I went home, I talked to my family. I was born in 1943, but not in Los Angeles. I was born in Manzanar, California, a concentration camp. The pain, the shame, the wanting to forget that terrible time in our history was so powerful for some families that they hadn't even told their children the truth about where they were born. And I think most of us here will remember that time as being a time when many families said, we don't talk about that. Don't talk about that time. Let's sweep it under the rug. So in the early 60s, we were not in a place as a community to want to rise up and demand justice. But again, the country continues to change in the 60s. The civil rights movement is underway. The anti-war movement, where young people, the Sanse in particular, learned that to say, hell no, I won't go, dissent was an American value. The women's rights movement and the Asian American studies movement all took place during that time. In the 70s, we start to now have more representation. Senator Inouye is in office, and in 1974, Norm Mineta, who was a 10-year-old boy when he and his family were sent off to Heart Mountain, Wyoming, is elected to the House of Representatives from San Jose, California. The story goes that Norm was a 10-year-old boy in his Cub Scout uniform when he and his family were loaded onto the train. He carried his baseball bat and his baseball glove. You don't get more American than that. Right, Mr. Kamey? And my baseball coach, Mr. Kamey, is in the audience, so he knows about that. As he was boarding the train, the armed sentry took away Norm's bat and said, you can't take this with you. It's a lethal weapon. I mean, that's symbolic of what the camps meant to our families. In 1976, Senator Spark Matsunaga is elected from the state of Hawaii. Senator Matsunaga was also a decorated war veteran during World War II. And in 1978, we have Bob Matsui, who was a six-month-old baby when he and his family were sent off to Tule Lake. So by the end of the 70s, we have now two decorated war veterans in the Senate, and we have two former American inmates of a concentration camp in the House of Representatives. We had four people representing us in Congress. But for those of you who were in the earlier session when I talked about there were really three different perspectives in the JA community at that time, the first said, let it go. We're doing so much better. We don't want to have to relive the pain and retell the stories. The second group said, no, what was done to us was wrong, and we are deserving of a good, clean apology. Don't put a price tag on our civil liberties. Just give us a good, clean apology. And the third group said, no, what was done to us was wrong. We are deserving of an apology, and we are deserving of monetary redress payments because what was done resulted in property losses. People lost their homes, their jobs, their businesses, their chances for a future. That debate continued on throughout the 70s as our community struggled to find its voice, to come together and finally demand redress. In 1978, the JACL, which was the largest and still remains the largest civil rights group in the Japanese American community, came together and passed a resolution saying, we want an apology, we want monetary redress payments, and we want it in the form of individual payments as well as a group trust fund. So they were ready now to go see the four representatives, two representatives and two senators in Congress. In 1979, there was a historic meeting between the members of the leadership of the JACL and Senator Inouye, Senator Matsunaga, Representative Mineta, and Representative Matsui. And they talked about the need for this piece of legislation. And as they talked, Senator Inouye listened very carefully. And finally, toward the end of the meeting, in his very deep voice, and I'm trying to go as low as I can, Senator Inouye said, I think you need a commission. And the jaws of the JACL leadership dropped because they knew that to have a commission explore and study the problem would take time. It would take years for the commission to complete its study. It would take another year for the commission to write its findings. And there was no guarantee that what they would find or what they would decide would be in our favor. And at that time in the late 70s, it was estimated that 200 elderly Japanese Americans were passing away each month. So every month that we waited, justice delayed would be justice permanently denied those individuals. We ultimately decided to go with what Senator Inouye said, because he was right. The American people did not know about the camps in the late 70s. The U.S. Congress was not fully aware of what happened in World War II in the late 70s. In fact, in 1979, there were only 10 representatives and 8 senators who had still been in office during World War II. So there was very little institutional memory. So a bill was created that created the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. This was a commission that was made up of 9 individuals, former ambassadors, former senators, one sitting congressional representative, and a couple judges, and a Jesuit priest, who went across the nation to 10 different cities and heard testimony from over 750 individuals in big cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And one of the most memorable moments in my life was that I attended the Los Angeles hearings. And I sat in a room, and if you can see the photographs, the room is jam-packed with hundreds of people in that room, primarily Japanese Americans. And there were overflow rooms where the testimonies were piped out. And I sat in that room and listened day after day to testimony as Japanese Americans finally got up and started to tell their story, often for the very first time. And there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. And I can't tell you what it meant to me as a 20-year-old college student, because my father and mother, they're Nisei. My father in particular, a Korean War vet, he never cried. He never shed a tear. And to see a room full of Japanese Americans with tears in their eyes hearing these stories. There was one man in the Los Angeles hearings, Kiyoshi Sonoda. He was a dentist. And he talked about his first patient, a young, dehydrated infant. And he was at camp. And he said, under normal circumstances, he would be able to treat that infant and make him well. But because he didn't have the proper supplies or equipment, all he could do was hold that infant in his hands and feel his last twitch before he died. And as he told this story, Dr. Sonoda had tears streaming down his eyes. And in the audience, his wife was sitting there, and she said, "Kiyoshi is crying. Kiyoshi doesn't cry. Kiyoshi didn't even cry at his own father's funeral." But on that day, Dr. Sonoda did cry. And an entire community cried with him and cried out for justice. And as powerful as those testimonies were at the commission hearings, I would submit to you that the more powerful testimonies occurred in people's homes, around their dining room tables, in their living rooms. As our sansei would say to their nisei parents and isei grandparents, "Tell us what happened. Tell us your stories." And the nisei and isei would, in some cases, tell the stories for the very first time. And they, in turn, would ask their sansei children, "Can we win this redress? Can we get an apology?" And the answer was, "We don't know, but we have to try." The commission hearings, even though they were designed to push forward the legislation that eventually came about, really were a culminating experience for our community. As families who a decade earlier weren't telling their children the truth about where they were born, were now sharing the stories of the injustice that they had survived and endured. And it was a very, very powerful time. The commission hearings came out in 1983 with their findings and in a book called Personal Justice Denied. And in that write-up, the commission clearly stated that the camps were wrong and that the camps were the result of wartime hysteria, racial prejudice, and a failure of political leadership. A failure of political leadership. Very powerful words to aim against one of the most beloved presidents of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And with that, we were ready to go on to fight in Congress. And I'm going to end at this point because that gives you a sense of how we went from leaving the camps to being ready to fight for the legislation in Congress. And we'll hear from our colleagues about what happened in Canada, and as Art suggested, begin to compare and contrast.
Our next speaker is Marika Umatsu. And she is a judge, and a judge for several decades. She's Canada's first female judge, in fact, of East Asian ancestry. And she, like Mitch, is a sansei. She was born in 1948, and sometimes it's more difficult to locate a woman's birth date. In spite of the end of sexism, she was raised in Hamilton, Ontario. And she was a key figure on the National Association of Japanese Canadians strategy and negotiation team, which, after a very hard-fought battle, achieved victory with the Civil Rights Act of 1988 in Canada. In 1992, Judge Omatsu wrote an influential book, a book that I have not read, called Bittersweet Passage, Redress and the Japanese Canadian Experience, but a book that I certainly will read. I've had shared with me by her some of her writings, and if they're anything like her writings, et cetera, they will be an altogether powerful experience. That book won awards. It was also published in a Japanese version. She does have an article that appears on the Japanese American National Museum's global website, which is in, called Discover Nikkei, and the article is called Lessons from the Japanese Canadian Experience. Well, she will give all of us some lessons and everything very, very shortly. So, Judge, would you please come up?
Thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm very pleased to be here in Seattle and to be speaking at this conference. It's very full up here. I'm going to be talking about the Japanese-Canadian experience, and I'll do a little bit of an explanation of our history, so you'll get a sense of what's the same and what's different. Can you hear me? No. Can you turn that up a bit? Okay. The migration and settlement of Japanese nationals in North America was at times a saga of unrelenting racism and discrimination. It was also the story of survival and accommodation, not only for the immigrant minority, but also for their adopted countries. In many ways, the histories of American and Canadian Japanese are mirror images of one another. The variations reflect the social and political differences between the two nations. Having won independence from Britain through revolution and having fought a civil war to end slavery, Americans, now I'm probably going to offend half of you, so I apologize in advance. Whenever you make generalizations, you could be generally wrong, but Americans are generally acknowledged to be more nationalistic, cohesive, and cognizant of racism and individual rights than Canadians. Canada, by comparison, chose to remain a British colony, and on its founding in 1867, entered into an uneasy marriage between the then English majority, it was 61%, and the conquered French minority, 31%. Positioned on a huge landmass with a small population, thinly spread along the U.S. border, Canada is a nation in search of its own unique identity, while nonetheless continually in step with its big brother to the south. More supportive of group rights and social justice, Canadians, and again speaking in broad generalizations, have been both more racist, but also more tolerant of difference than I argue to our friends to the south, namely you guys. The winning of redress in September 22, 1988, restored honor to my community. On that day in Parliament, and I was pleased to say I was there, then Prime Minister Mulroney publicly acknowledged that the Canadian government during World War II had, quote, wrongly incarcerated, seized the property, and disenfranchised thousands of citizens of Japanese ancestry. End of quote. The settlement package included $21,000 to each individual affected, and we received that money immediately. And those affected went up to April 1949, totaling some $400 million. A community rebuilding fund of $15 million, which through wise management and donations turned to over $100 million. Legal safeguards to prevent a reoccurrence and the establishment of a race relations foundation to combat racism. For Japanese Canadians, it was our sweetest moment. And for all Canadians, it marks one of the most significant civil rights victories in our country's history. I feel extremely fortunate to have been a participant in that struggle as a member of the National Association of Japanese Canadians legal and strategy team during the campaign and as one of their negotiators with the government. And to this day, I remain empowered by our triumph. Today, in those days, we were just over 21,000. Today, we are about 70,000. And my community is still one of Canada's smallest minority groups. And we're strung out in tiny numbers across the countries along the track of the National Railway. And today, unfortunately, in Canada, there is no Japantown, no geographical heart where the country's pulse can still be felt. So you are lucky. With roots in Canada going back to the 1870s, we are per capita among the country's most highly paid, educated, and assimilated. In short, an ethnic success story. With virtually no immigration from Japan, apparently it's about 250 a year, an intermarriage rate of almost 95%, fifth generation of 25% Japanese ancestry. Now in my family, for example, I'm a sansei, the gosei, when you combine us all together, I'm in a racial minority. So I feel that our fate is sealed. In the words of an old Japanese saying, when the river enters the sea, the muddy river water mixes with the sea and is gone forever. Yet it was not always this way. At one time in our history, we were visible, shunned, and discriminated against, the most hated minority in our country. And this is a little bit of the history I'll tell you about because it's different from yours. In Canada in 1895, the British Columbia government passed legislation denying the vote and the right to run for political office to all Asians. And those would be people from China, Japan, and India. Since being on the provincial voters list was a frequent job requirement, many employment doors were slammed shut. So basically couldn't be civil servants, couldn't work as teachers, and many of the professions were also closed to Japanese Canadians, and that's like law and pharmacy. So we're now moving to the war, and this is very similar to you. This is our executive order. And I'll just quickly go through these slides. There's nine of them. And this was sort of the temper of the times. And, of course, these are scenes that are unfortunately similar between our experiences. And these camps were located in very desolate and barren parts of British Columbia. So during the war, so this would have been early 1942, the entire community of just over 22,000 was uprooted and relocated into camps deep in the BC interior. Men were often separated from their families and put into work camps. This was done despite the advice from the Canadian military to Canada's Mackenzie King government that Japanese Canadians did not pose a defense threat. And this is quite different from you. In 1943, the Canadian government seized and sold all our property, personal and real estate and what have you, farms, boats, everything, and used the proceeds towards the cost of the internment. After the war in 1946, people were still in the camps. The government attempted to deport and exile the entire community to war decimated Japan. And in fact, in 1947, 20% of our community left Canada on American troop carriers for Japan, a country most did not know and most did not speak Japanese. The remainder still held in camps were dispersed across the country, and we were prohibited from returning to the west coast of British Columbia until April 1949. The surrender of Imperial Japan in 1945 marked the end of World War II, but for my community, it didn't end until 1949. And this is what I think is the difference between how we sought redress and how you were able to win redress. Until fairly recently, my community was without representation in the Canadian power elite. As compared to the U.S., we had no senators or politicians or judges to influence the state's apparatus. Thus, out of necessity, ours was a grassroots movement, and we had to make redress a concern for all Canadians. Here in the U.S., reparations for Americans of Japanese ancestry was a political question fought out in Congress. And I don't have to go through your history, but as you know, you were getting the Civil Liberties Act through Congress and signed by Reagan. In Canada, we lacked the power to even meet with our prime minister, let alone lobby him to pass a redress bill. As a lawyer, I observed what my colleagues in the States were doing. And in Chicago, N.C. Jarre lawyers were pursuing a multi-billion dollar lawsuit based on constitutional infringements. And of course, in California and in the West Coast, they were bringing the quorum nobis applications against the convictions. But in Canada, we had no constitution. There was no constitution. And all Canadian government actions had been protected by self-serving laws and racist legal decisions that, like a dank cloak, continued to shield the government from legal challenges in the courts. I think as well there are some relevant differences in political culture between our two countries. We believe in Canada that the U.S. political culture places a higher priority on the legal rights of individuals and is suspicious of government. While Canada, still imbued with a Tory-like ethic of peace, order, and good government. So for us, legal action against the government is not the first line of attack when we think about what to do about a wrong. However, we did have our share of sensei lawyers, I among them, and we were envious of what our colleagues in the U.S. were doing, and I would come down and visit, and we followed their actions, but over the years, we left few stones unturned in our legal quest, but in the end, our brush with the legal system ultimately played a minor role in our victory. And given how poor we were, the NAJC would have had to won redress first before we could secure the funds to go down this path. We discovered that in terms of political action, and the only one that we found feasible was to add our voices for the calling of the repeal of the War Measures Act. And that was the piece of legislation that had permitted the draconian measures that had been taken against us. In fact, we were part of a coalition of groups who lobbied for the repeal of the act. And in 1988, the War Measures Act was replaced by the Emergencies Act, which ensures greater civil rights protections. So in our view, the only viable option left for us was the public forum. And here we took advantage of what we thought was the difference between our two countries. So our government places a high value on the preservation of multiculturalism as opposed to what you call here the melting pot, and appeals to social justice and equity strike very receptive chords in the population as a whole. So even today, with our conservative government, a cost-cutting government, and enthralled as our government is with neo liberal political and economic theories, they have been constrained to deny that they wish to dismantle popular social service programs such as our health care program. And all politicians promise to preserve multicultural diversity. So our result was that we could appeal to these sentiments, and we took our case directly to the public. We explained our history in high school forums, trade union halls, and to the newspapers and media. And by the mid-80s, our government's argument to eliminate or to grant minimal financial compensation was in the end even rejected by the government. And such a decision was upheld by public opinion polls and press sentiment. So I've been told by Art I have 3 minutes left, so I'll rush to the end. So within our community, of course, there were factions that needed to be won over. And we realized that within the broader Canadian community, we could not survive a head-to-head confrontation with the government. David, with his slingshot, needed only to hit Goliath's tragic flaw, but we lacked even David's simple weapon. We, therefore, needed to make redress a matter of concern for all Canadians. So we had to win over the media, which we did, and we found that they were convinced by indisputable documentation and hard facts. Then we built a coalition, and we found our coalition among all the folks you would assume, the churches, ethnic and visible minorities, the trade union movement, civil libertarians, support from the Canadian Chinese, Jewish, and Mennonite communities. However, we never did get support from the British, Conservative Party, the Chambers of Commerce, members of the Canadian business establishment, and unfortunately for myself, that time, then I still am a feminist, not from the women's movement at all. And in the 80s, racism was not considered a women's issue. And actually, our only vocal opponents were the World War II vets. We did not have the 442. We weren't allowed to be in the Army until just basically months before the end. By the late 1980s, public opinion was turning in our favor. And one thing we did was a full-page advertisement in the Globe and Mail, which is our New York Times. And that was sponsored by the Canadian Council of Churches. And we did a big mass demonstration on in Ottawa. And I'm showing this slide because at the front, holding the sign, "Negotiate with the NAJC," is my mother. And all my life, she had always said, "Oh, do not involve yourself in demonstrations." And of course, being a student in the 60s and 70s, part of getting a university degree was going to demonstrations. And she was always saying, "Oh, the RCMP will arrest you." So I'm so pleased that here she is. Anyway, we did get a redress settlement in September of 1988. And I asked myself, why did we? And I think that part of the reason had to be the Reagan signed the $1.25 billion Civil Liberties Act that compensated Japanese Americans, because Mulroney gave us redress a few days later. As well, I wondered whether or not at that time Japan was a big economic power. I suppose in some senses it still is. And I speculate that perhaps there was a nervous tremor from Tokyo that questioned Canada's pre-war precedent, whereby the property of Japanese had been people of Japanese ancestry had been seized and sold without compensation. And I know the JACL had met with then Prime Minister Nakasone, and that he had become a supporter of reparations for Japanese Americans. Anyway, however, I like to reassure myself that regardless of whatever tawdry, or perhaps not tawdry, machinations might in the end be revealed to explain the U.S. and Canadian settlements, they did establish powerful precedents, limiting the power of the state and protecting minority rights. I fervently hoped that our settlement will stand as an impediment against other Canadians having to go through our experience. And this is our signing in Ottawa, and there is a much younger woman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marika. Our final speaker is Joy Kogawa, who probably is one of those people who doesn't need an introduction, but I'll give her one anyway. People have disliked the use of a term, an iconic figure, because it's been used so many times that it's been stretched out of shape to the point where it has very little meaning. But if we could go back to its original meaning, she is an iconic figure. She was born in Vancouver, British Columbia in 1935. She, of the three people, experienced the World War II exclusion and detention experience with her family. In 1981, she was catapulted to a great deal of acclaim, not only literary but extra literary, for her semi-autobiographical novel, Aubusson. And in 1992, she wrote a book entitled Itsuka, which unfortunately I have not read, either in its original form, or she revised it some years later in 2005, calling it Emily Kato. And I've tried to get both of these, and I will try in more earnest to get them. She concentrated in that book, which was a sequel to Aubusson, on the emotional and the political dimensions of the Japanese-Canadian redress movement. And she spent 5 years of her life really fully immersed in the redress movement. And she is one of those people who I think gives all for what she's doing. And this is true not only in a campaign like this that has political dimensions, but I think in the way she writes, in viewing several of her interviews, I can see that she is very elevated in my mind and the mind of many other people, because for her it's very difficult to write, not because she doesn't have verbal facility, you know, but because I think it's painful to have to work through and try to be able to say things as well as they need to be said so that they have a lasting sort of significance. She got one bad review for her at Suka, which spent her into a tailspin. She has come out of it and written many other things, including children's books. And I've read a couple of those, and all of them really revolve around a central experience in her life. So she's going to share us that central experience with us today, and she's going to emphasize the emotional and political aspects of that experience, right?
Thank you, Art. And I have a confession. I couldn't hear Marika because I left my hearing aids in Toronto. And I was really, so I might repeat some of the things you said, but I don't know. This is what happens when you get old, some of us. Anyway, it's so amazing to be here. I was just saying to Marika, can you imagine something like this happening in Canada? Something of this, I mean, of course we're just a few of us compared to how many there are of you, but it's far more than that. There's a spirit of togetherness that, although I'm sure there are huge amounts of differences amongst all of you too, as there are with us, there is still enough togetherness that you can do this huge thing and talk together and come to at least what seems like unity from our point of view, from, you know, what we see. We I think the main difference between what happened to Japanese Americans and what happened to Japanese Canadians was the dispersal policy that happened in Canada, which was the will of the country that we should never be a community again. And when we were of the age of developing our identities, what we knew that we were and had to be, because the country decreed it, was that we were, each of us, the only Jap in town. And that's what we grew up to be. And I kept that identity quite faithfully practically all my life. And so it was hard for me to be with Japanese Canadians. I would go around saying quite proudly, I don't know any Japanese Canadians. It's like before the women's movement, we used to not want to be with each other in some way, or to be proud to be women. So for me, it was a kind of loss of belonging. And here we are, the original belongingness people. I mean, we said, we Japanese, that was a phrase that we used, but we were no longer we Japanese. What were we? We were the only Jap in town. So this huge denial of who we were. And for most of the people that I know that are Niseis, that's still there. For the Niseis of my generation and a little bit older than me, I know so many who just never knew other Japanese Canadians, and they never married. I know lots of families like that. It's so surprising. I wish there were a study done. Maybe there is. I don't know about it. I don't, in fact, know that much about Japanese Canadians. I used to say if I hadn't written Obasan, I wouldn't read it. I didn't want to know about Japanese Canadians. And so to be with a bunch of people who are not ashamed to be together at all, it's quite something. It's a very healing kind of envy, kind of funny feeling that I have that you have here. And I wish we had that. I wish we were more together. I wish that there was the striving for conscience that I get through my pores by being at this conference. That struggle to be better, to count, to make your voice heard. I wonder if that exists in our community. Not in quite the same way. Anyway, I knew that Marika was going to cover the points. She was going to give the facts, and I was relegated then to anecdotes and personal stories. And first thing I want to say is that it's a great thrill for me that my one and only brother is here. I hardly ever see him because he lives in Seattle and I'm in Canada, and I don't know how to get down. So he's here, my brother Tim, who served as a priest at St. Peter's here in Seattle for many years. And we have a story to tell, too, which shows a difference in the ethos in Canada at the time that we were kids and the ethos in Seattle that at least existed in St. Peter's. That particular story, I think I can show as an example of the difference. But before I talk about that, I also want to talk about a certain border crossing that we all share. And that border crossing was that moment, that time, when redress was achieved, that great celebration when that happened. That happened in Canada, that happened in the United States. That was a moment that we all crossed. And what did that mean to us? For me, that moment meant I no longer have the right to be a victim in that way. I have crossed over. So all my sense of victimization that I had come with and that I carry and that is in my body and still there, it is still there, What I have to do now from that point on is practice another identity, another role. I am no longer going to indulge my sense of victimization. Because I think when people do come to those crossover points and don't cross over to another identity, and if they stay stuck in the role of victim when they are no longer officially victims, then you can do terrible things because you cannot see the victimization of other people and you are concentrated on your own and you remain stuck there when the reality has changed. And so, for example, you can have a wonderful people like the Israelis who see themselves in many ways as victims of the Palestinians and therefore can perpetuate injustices because of a sense of victimhood that is so overwhelming and so large that they haven't been able, many of them haven't been able to cross over. And maybe in another generation, maybe it takes a long time to get beyond that personal experience, that Holocaust that was experienced and internalized. So victimization can be carried on by victimizers who have not crossed over to the other side. So my practice of being a victimizer then, I took upon myself the identity of the Christian in relation to the Jew. And I practiced that identity, and I searched for the root causes of anti-Semitism right within the heart of Christianity. And I practiced that identity. And more recently, I have been practicing the identity of the people who were harmed by the Japanese Imperial Army, the identity of my Japanese ancestry, which I can take upon myself now. I was not the only victim of the war in Japan, against the war in Asia. The fact that the Japanese Imperial Army did those unbelievable, barbaric things impacted on the views that were then spread across that all Japs were a kind of cruel and evil race. And there was at least, I read somewhere, 1% of people in North America who believed that we were genetically cruel, therefore should be eliminated. Certainly, that feeling existed in Vancouver when I was a child, that feeling that we should not exist in Canada. And there was a great will to remove us out of the country altogether, which was what caused that deportation or that exile or whatever we want to call that expulsion of us, wanting us out of the country. And then when there was an outcry against that and 4,000 of us were gone, at least they stopped that process and we could stay. But the compromise against sending us out, because the will, it was in Parliament, that you should read some of the things that are written in Hansard about what the politicians said about us. But the will then changed, and the compromise was the dispersal policy. That is that we should not be a community again. Our identity should be completely squelched. And that worked. And the community was destroyed. There are pockets of people here and there who still congregate in churches and so on. But my brother and I were raised as Anglicans, and here's the story that I want to come to, the story of what the Anglican Church did in Vancouver, as contrasted to what the Episcopalians did with their church here in Seattle. There were two bishops that were involved. One was Sir Francis Heathcott, the bishop of New Westminster, and that is called the Vancouver area. And the other was Bishop Houston. And we have this story because my brother was here and heard of it and knew it firsthand. Here's what happened in Seattle. Bishop Houston, he was a good shepherd. He was a good bishop. He cared for his flock. And when the people were being sent away, he had them put some of their belongings in St. Peter's, in the auditorium, in the hall, and they were all marked off in these little squares. And when the people in the camps wrote to him. He personally went down, he got their pieces for them, and he mailed it to them. Now that's love. That's the work of the Good Shepherd. And so that contrasts so severely with what happened to the Japanese Anglicans. It's our dad who had a church. I mean, we had three churches there. But the one church that was so beautiful, I wish I had the picture for it. I could show you it. And the videos, that the movies that he took of our congregation, of our life in Vancouver at the time. There were lots of us. And there was a beautiful church, a very beautiful church, that was built, and it was dedicated in 1935, the year I was born. So there it was. And when Tim, my brother, who we were dispersed and we were sent to southern Alberta to the sugar beet field area, we were only sent to places where people would accept us, and there we were living in the shack and I can't tell you how horrible it was in this constant wind and the dust and in this shack, and we'd lost everything, and there we were. I mean, so after we were allowed to go back, it was 19. I mean, Tim, maybe you were about the first student that went back. He went to UBC after high school, and he really wanted to know what had happened to those churches, because after 1949, the people were starting to come back, because that's when we were allowed to move around. That's when we got our freedom. So Tim went to the bishop, and with my godfather, who was Canon Gale, and he asked the bishop, I don't remember what the words were that he exactly used, but he wanted to know what had happened to our churches. Do you remember what you said? Well, that's what the bishop at the time, when Tim asked what happened to our churches, the bishop didn't answer, but he took Tim out into the hallway, and he called Mr. Matheson, who was the treasurer. And he said, all right, Tim, put your question to the treasurer. He's the one that's got the answers. Of course, the bishop knew what had happened to the churches. But the only thing that the treasurer said were three words. They were relinquished. Now, what on earth that meant, Tim? Tim went, he was a shock. Here were our churches, which were needed because people were coming back, and they weren't there anymore. What had happened to them? So he went back and he looked up the word and he found out what it meant, and he was just stunned. Well, it took how many years? 60 years after that for us to finally find out what had happened to our churches. It wasn't the government that sold our churches. The government sold all our properties. The government, okay. And then what had happened then is that in 1945, when we were given our freedom, the first year the church was sold was 45, wasn't it? And then in 49, just as we were starting to come back, they got in a hurry and they sold the rest, so that we had nowhere to go home to. Now that, and you know what happened to the money? The money from the sale did not come to help us, who were scattered across the country. The money went into the bishop's endowment fund to pay the bishop's salary. Okay, so this is the kind of the difference. That's the church. You wonder why any of us ever stayed within an organization as corrupt as that. But some of us have remained believers in another realm that is one of infinite love and infinite kindness. We hold to that. And in spite of what the church in its great flawed ways has done. When this story came to the Anglican headquarters and was told by the Council of General Synod, there was a great healing moment for me when the primate heard the story, and I saw reflected in his face a great grief. And for me, the sight of that grief told me that he knew our suffering. He felt it. And that was healing. It's when we are fully known, then we are healed because we are loved. And that's what I think, for me, the redress movement is about. Is about telling the story so that people know and can feel. And when they do, we can be healed. And that healing is still to come for so many of us. And I think it will be there for us when there is a kind of magnanimity that is able to rise up in spite of everything that has happened. That's when I'll know we are healed. Till then, we wait.
Well, I had a flash to three fingers for 3 minutes, first to a judge and then to an icon. And the reason I did was because a big part of these sessions are the Q&A part. And now where you have an opportunity as an interactive opportunity to be able to raise concerns and questions with the people on the panel. So please raise your hand. Yes.
Well, I have some pertinent information. I'm an American, but I do belong to the Greater Vancouver Japanese Canadian Citizens Association, and I have a deep and abiding interest in the Japanese Canadian experience. So I have done a lot of research and investigation, and I've attended their conferences. And I'd just like to point out some differences that I found out between the Japanese Canadian and the Japanese American experience. For instance, America mentioned that Japanese Canadians could not vote. But the East, they could be naturalized, they could own land, and there were no anti-miscegenation laws in British Columbia, where the majority of Japanese Canadians lived.
Oh. And after Pearl Harbor was bombed, Japanese Canadian men between the ages of 18 and 45 were sent to road camps to support the families. And those that protested were arrested and detained and sent to Petawawa and later to a permanent camp called Angler in Ontario. And Japanese Canadians paid for their own internment. They had to work. They were sent to places, mostly ghost towns, but not all of them. Some of them were farmland and woodland. And someone who had lived in New Denver told me they thought New Denver was a lovely place. So it's a little different from the U.S. camp experience. They were sent to places where there were lakes and mountains, so they didn't think it was a terrible place to live in. And they did have a choice of where they could move to. Some people, and I think America's family, did go to a self-supporting place. Is that true? In Bridge River? They went to places like Bridge River, Chase, Taylor, and Christina Lake, and they had to support themselves. They were mostly wealthier people because they paid for their own transportation, according to what this one man told me.
We have only about 5 more minutes, so I'm going to have to...
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll just give about maybe 2 more minutes. Would that be okay?
Well, that will leave only 3 minutes for the rest of the group.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Thank you very kindly, though, for illuminating that. That was very good. And people want to talk to him afterwards. And let's other questions that you might have? Yes.
Is it on? Okay. Two of you, especially Judge Omotsu, you gave the reason, the difference between Canadian Japanese and American Japanese. I think the reason you gave is a political difference, a political atmosphere, difference in political atmosphere. I just wonder if education played any part. Education in the States and education in Canada played any part in difference of Japanese Canadians and Japanese Americans, how they reacted to get the redress. Omotsu-san and Maki-san, everyone, if you can.
I'm not sure what do you mean, education.
Education meaning that how Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians affected by Canadian education system or the American education system or the quality of education.
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, in terms of higher education, it's easier for Canadians to go to university, for poorer people to go to university than Americans, because our universities are subsidized. Can't hear?
Mariko, I think she's asking a little different question. I think she's asking to what extent in the classrooms of the United States as opposed to Canada were people being sensitized to the topic.
Well, there was no discussion about what happened to Japanese Canadians when I was growing up. I think there was a line or so in my high school history book, but, you know, in a 200 or 300 page history book, that was meaningless. And certainly I think from my discussions with my friends in the United States, similarly, the Nisei parents didn't tell us anything that happened anyway. So for myself as a sensei, I grew up not knowing really very much about what had happened to my community and my parents until I was in university. And I have a feeling that it was might have been similar in the United States. Am I wrong, Mitch?
Do you want to excuse me. I think there. I'm not sure how it was in Canada, so it's an excellent question. But I think, as I mentioned, in the 1960s, we had the emergence of the ethnic studies movement in the United States. And for many sansei, they began to see themselves in a larger context, and they began to see the racism that was perpetrated on other groups and the parallels of the Japanese-American experience being not a social misfortune, because that's how our community viewed the camps up until the 60s, that it was a social misfortune that we were born Japanese and therefore we had to go to camp during World War II, Shikata Ganai. But in the 60s, with the ethnic studies movement, our young sansei began to understand that, no, it wasn't a social misfortune. It was a political injustice. It was something that was perpetrated upon us by other people, and it was wrong, and it was something that we needed to change. So I think in answer to your question, the ethnic studies movement played a big role. Now, granted, in K through 12, students would still get one sentence in their history book if they were lucky. But at least the sanseis who immersed themselves in the Third World Movement and the ethnic studies movement began to see the world through a different sort of lens.
Other questions? Right back there.
I just wanted to offer, as you said, it's difficult to generalize, and I wanted to say that I particularly identify with Joy's comments because, Mitch, you were on the West Coast.
Right.
And when I moved to the West Coast, I was amazed at how empowered the sansei generation were. But I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. My parents moved there after being in Jerome to start a new life. And so, Joy, I really related to you. We were the only Japs in town, as you said, you know, in an all-white community. So it's difficult to generalize about an experience on either side of the border. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Marika and Joy and Mitch as well. It's very interesting to know when you look at the redress, the actual final. Joy, you talked about the fact that the conservative government in Canada did not support redress, but in actual fact, Mulroney being a conservative signed the bill, and in fact, Reagan being a Republican signed the bill in the United States. What was it that made that happen when, you know, we had plenty of other opportunities relative to liberal governments and Democratic-led governments to do this? So what were the things that made that happen at the time? Just the movements had reached that pinnacle?
Well, my theory was that our Prime Minister Mulroney was influenced by your president, and they were both buddies of one another, by the fact that Japan was an economic power, and there was some concern by Prime Minister Nakasone at the time and Japanese businessmen, and the fact that the Japanese-Canadian community was a constant thorn in the side of the government. We did not go away, and we would not go away. As Sensei, we were always saying, we'll have to leave it to the Yonsei, and they'll carry on. But thank goodness we didn't have to. So I think those are part of the reason. But I have to tell you that when I wrote my book, I put that in my book, and I gave it to he's the former Prime Minister, Mulroney, who had signed the bill. And he flipped through the book and looked at wherever it said Mulroney, and and he saw what I had said, that he had signed it because Reagan had signed it. And he said, "No, you're wrong." He said, "I signed it because it was the right thing to do." Well, I hope that's true.
Well, I'm sure that Reagan would have said the same thing. One more question, I think we're moving into the territory towards the next, set of sessions. So, one more question.
Go ahead.
Dr. Maggie has a comment.
No, go ahead and answer, and then I'll put in my two cents.
No, go ahead.
No, please. I defer to you.
Go ahead. Who was it?
about Mulroney signing the bill.
Oh, yeah. I just remember, is this working?
Yes.
What I remember is Roger Obata, who was a war veteran, and right at the front of all that. And Mulroney said that to him, too. And Roger said to me, "Do you believe that?" I don't.
I think in the United States, it's a very critical question. And I have to admit, I was one of those Sensei activists who thought, we got it through the House, we got it through the Senate. There is no way that Ronald Reagan is signing this bill. We fought the good fight, we educated people, but it's over. You know, and I have to admit that that was my perspective. Mm-hmm. But we had the true believers who kept pushing this forward. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who can remember Ronald Reagan, whether you agreed with his policies or not, many people would agree that he was a great communicator. He could tell stories that would move the hearts and minds of audiences. And the opposite was true of Ronald Reagan. If you could tell him a story that would touch his heart, you could have a great advocate on your hands. So the question was, what story could we tell Ronald Reagan that would have any chance of moving his heart? Well, there was a sergeant named Kazuo Masuda who had died in battle fighting for the United States of America, an American war hero. After the war, his family moves back to Santa Ana, California, and they want to bury their son in the local cemetery. But the community says, no, we want no Jap body in our community. Never mind that he was an American hero, an American war veteran, no Jap body. The Army, realizing that this is a PR fiasco, sends out a contingent of Army officers. And on that day, there was a white American captain named Ronald Reagan. And he read these words to the family of Kazuo Masuda. He said, "The blood that is soaked into the sand is all of one color. America stands unique in the world, the only country not founded on race, but on an ideal. Mr. and Mrs. Masuda, as one member of the American family to another, for what your son Kazuo did, thanks." Now, he didn't write those words, but he read them with great feeling because he was a great actor. Right. But we got Grant Uchifusa helped to get that story back to President Reagan through Governor Tom Kaine of New Jersey. And when President Reagan read that story, his response was, "I remember that day. I remember what the Nisei soldiers did for America." Now, that started to, I think, move him in that direction. I think it also helped that it was an opportunity for him, the great Republican president, to undo the great wrong that the great Democrat president, Franklin Roosevelt, had committed. And I think that was important to him. And finally, and I think possibly most importantly, he signed it in 1988, his last year in office. I don't know if he would have signed it in his second year of office. So timing was on our side that it came before him at a point where he could be a little freer to do what he felt was the right thing to do. I'm not so sure about the rise of Japan as a nation, because we had Japan bashing at that time, but I know Asian Americans were beginning to flex their muscle in terms of being a constituency here in the United States, and that may have played a little bit of a role in it too, as seeing this up-and-coming constituency in America.
Well, I think that wraps up our session, and thanks to all of you for coming here, and most especially, let's thank the panelists for their contributions.
Thank you. I'm very interested in meeting you.